Hi, I'm DW from Houston.
Hi, I'm Kristen from San Francisco.
Hi, I'm Graham from Vancouver, Canada.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did. It's easy.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate. Yes!
I'm Jesse Thorne. There's something really to be said, and I say this as someone who fell into this category, for being a sissy heterosexual in high school. It
Absolutely.
Can really work out for you.
Well, I mean, I think you're seen as non-threatening by females, and as long as you're in an environment where you're not seen as threatening by males, you can really thrive.
It depends on your ability to sort of make the pivot, so to speak.
You mean the pivot from friendship to romance?
Yeah.
Well, you just got to pounce. you know, and then, you know, you can't pounce so much that you get a reputation as a pouncer. You just got to pounce enough.
Me and Daniel Handler, romantics at heart, this week on Bullseye. On this week's show, Daniel Handler delves into his memories of young love to pen the novel Why We Broke Up. The twist? He writes from the girl's perspective. And the Sklar brothers, from performing as identical twins to broadening their sports nerd fan base. Plus, I suggest the Canadian sitcom The Newsroom, and composer Nico Muhly shares the song that changed his life. Stick around for Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Every week, we turn to some of our favorite culture critics for recommendations in the world of pop culture. This week, we turn to Genevieve Kosky, the assistant editor of the AV Club, and Josh Modell, the AV Club's general manager, who join us from their offices in Chicago to give us some all-time favorites. Josh, why don't we start with you? You chose Fiona Apple's When the Pawn... From 1999. Let's take a little bit of a listen to a song from the record. When I think of it, my fingers turn to fists. I never did anything that you meant. But no matter what I try, you beat me with your bitter lies. So call me crazy, hold me down, make me cry. Get off now, baby. It won't be long till you be lying, living your own hands. Fiona Apple has had this really... I don't know, how would you describe it? A crazy, bouncing all over the place, good news, bad news type of career. But she has retained a passionate fan base because of records like this one. What does this album mean to you?
That's a tough question, so I'll answer a different question and say I just think it's a really excellent album by a person who's kind of, in a way, was very critically underrated at the time. Her first record came out, and she did this sexy video, and was kind of written off in a way as you know, trying to be a sex symbol or whatever. And then add on top of that the sort of impression that she gives us that she's pretty crazy, and then doesn't put out records but every 5 years.
And then makes some 90-word album titles.
Yeah, yeah. The new one that's coming out sometime this year has something like 23 words in the title.
The actual full album title, if I may, is When the Pawn Hits the Conflict, He Thinks Like a King, What He Knows Throws the blows when he goes to the fight, and he'll win the whole thing for he enters the ring. There's no body to batter when your mind is your might. So when you go solo, you hold your own hand and remember the depth that is the greatest of heights. And if you know where you stand, then you know where to land. And if you fall, it won't matter because you'll know that you're right.
In a way, that's sort of indicative of what I'm talking about, and that she kind of distracts from her own music. Like, she gives ammunition to people to say, well, I'm not going to listen to that stupid album that's got a 99-word title. But luckily, she's got the goods to back it up.
Genevieve, let's talk about another record album. This one, A Badly Broken Code, by the Minneapolis-based, I don't know, spoken word artist, semi-rapper, Dessa. It was her first record. It came out a couple of years ago. And we're going to start by taking a listen to a clip from a song called Mineshaft 2.
You hung up the phone, you listened to the dial tone, and you stared at the stove. Until the beeping started, you read some love letters, some threats, and some you couldn't tell apart that you keep under the bed at the apartment. Then you did what he asked you to do. You opened your heart up right there on a napkin on the carpet. And part of it was frostbitten. But you've always been a smart kid, could still distinguish the blood black as pitch. Valves have gone stiff, veins and scar tissue.
So what speaks to you so strongly about this album, Genevieve?
Dessa, as you said, she came up as a spoken word artist. And actually, you know, I think it's fair to call her a singer-rapper at this point, but she does have a very unusual kind of spoken word-influenced flow that, when I first heard the album, actually kind of put me off of it. But her lyrics are just so fantastic, and it's an album that I felt kind of weird picking an album that's only 2 years old, calling it an all-time classic. But I've literally listened to this album at least once a week for the last 2 years, and I hear something new every time, like picking out a line or a different interpretation of a line. And it's maybe the reason this album sticks out is just because I engage with the lyrical content so much more than I usually would.
What are the themes there that you connect with?
It's one of those albums where I feel like every song I can kind of relate to on some level. You know, it's like, oh yeah, that happened to me. That's a perfect, that couplet is a perfect encapsulation of that thing that happened to me once, you know?
I feel that same way about the Geto Boys.
they're very similar artists in that regard.
Well, Josh, Genevieve, thank you so much for sharing your picks with us.
Thank you.
Can I just say, real gangsta ass Jesse, don't flex stuff, because real gangsta ass Jesse, no, he got him.
Josh Modell is the general manager of the AV Club. He recommends Fiona Apple's When the Pawn, etc., etc. Genevieve Kosky is the assistant editor. She recommends Dessa's A Badly Broken Code. You can find the AV Club in the pages of The Onion online at avclub.com, and you can check out their podcast, Reasonable Discussion. Some ghosts in the yourself. And here you are, a sick figure and a busted grin, still ignorant of all the trouble I'm a jettison. Hoping we could trade just for tonight. Like I could borrow your heart and I could leave you mine. It's not much for collateral, tattered and battle scarred, but I can promise you solemn that I will be back for tomorrow. I only need joys this evening, so I can call an old friend. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you were a teenager, which I'm guessing you were at some point, if you're not one now, you were probably at some point in love. And if you were in love as a teenager, you were probably out of love at some point too. It's that falling apart of love that's at the center of Daniel Handler's new novel, Why We Broke Up. It's a first-person letter. What's that, second person? Is that second person when you're writing a letter about something that happened to you?
It is, second person.
Oh, geez Louise. It's a second person.
Well, I mean, it's first person directed to a second person, so I don't know if it really counts as second person or first person.
Oh, geez. We're going to get letters, Daniel Handler.
That's true. Yes. Please direct your comments, listeners, to Daniel Handler, care of Barack Obama, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, D.C.
Anyway, his book takes the form of a series of letters written by a teenage girl to her erstwhile beau, accompanied by paintings of objects sent in a box. The paintings are by Myra Kalman, a past guest on this show. They're absolutely beautiful. If Daniel Handler's name sounds familiar, and it's not for his work under his own name, he's also a celebrated and best-selling author under the pen name The Lemony Snicket. His best-selling books there have been turned into movies and sold a bajillion copies, and he has appeared around the world as the Lemony Snicket's assistant or representative. Daniel Handler, welcome to Bullseye.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This book reminded me that I don't remember as much as I'd like to about high school. How close are you?
Don't you think that's probably a mercy?
I don't know. Like I had a great high school experience for the most part, but I genuinely feel bad about it. I mean, I'm not even especially old, but I lose touch with things very quickly, and I feel sort of sad about it. And I wonder how close you are to your high school experience.
Too close, clearly. I mean, I, for the most part, had a marvelous time in high school, but certainly those years made a huge impression on me. I still have the old gang from high school. We're all close and keep in touch. And I mean, for instance, in the promotional materials for this book, it says that I was dumped at least 3 times in high school. And when that was read out loud on a radio program, my friend from high school called me and said, "It's at least 5 times. I mean, those years have left a lasting impression, and I never thought of it as really a blessing. I always assumed it was a curse that I could remember things from that time quite well.
Tell me a little bit about yourself in high school, because I think your two protagonists in this book, Min, the voice of the book, the girl is a sort of... she is forever battling the descriptor artsy.
Yeah.
And her boyfriend is a jock. I mean, he is a bright jock. He's not a meathead. But he has that sort of blithe jockey quality where everything works out for him.
Yeah.
What were you like in high school?
I had the privilege of attending an academic high school here in San Francisco. So,
which you went to Lowell, right?
I went to Lowell High School indeed. And so it wasn't a kind of a sink or swim cesspool of violence that one often reads about in high schools. There wasn't, any typical bullying. And so a kind of, sissy heterosexual such as myself could do pretty well. And I did pretty well. I was artsy. I wouldn't have apologized about being artsy. And I had friends, and I mean, we were very, very pretentious. We enjoyed going to cafes, which in the pre-Starbucks era was in and of itself an artsy thing to do. And we watched a lot of films that I don't even understand now when I see them. And we listened to a lot of so-called difficult music. And, you know, we were small, incestuous groups, and we developed very high, passionate crushes on one another and such. And I wanted to be a writer the whole time. I wanted to be a writer.
There's something really to be said, and I say this as someone who fell into this category, for being a sissy heterosexual in high school. It
Absolutely.
Can really work out for you.
Well, I mean, I think you're seen as non-threatening by females. And as long as you're in an environment where you're not seen as threatening by males, you can really thrive.
It depends on your ability to sort of make the pivot, so to speak.
You mean the pivot from friendship to romance?
Yeah.
Well, you just got to pounce. you know, and then you know you can't pounce so much that you get a reputation as a pouncer. You just got to pounce enough.
You're now describing something that sounds inappropriate and upsetting.
I'm sorry. Do you need to talk this over with your wife? Is that where this is going?
I'm a little bit not sure about this pouncing thing that you're working over.
Oh, well, I'm not working over it now. I've been married to a woman forever and ever. But in high school, yeah, you're friends with someone and you go to a movie and you both agree it's very significant. And then you walk across the Golden Gate Bridge and the fog is covering the city with mystery and allure. And if you don't make a move then you're going to be friends forever.
There's this thing about romance in high school where it is almost exhaustingly important. I mean, everything in high school is exhaustingly important, right? But...
Well, it's either exhaustingly important or not even worth mentioning. There's certainly not anything in between, I think, for most people in high school.
Do you find it easy to recall that level of... I don't know, that level of emotional intensity?
I think I do. I think it comes naturally to me. I mean, I think my memories of high school, for whatever reason, are pretty clear. And then also, I'm in a field that requires a certain amount of obsession to do well. If you're a novelist, it means you have to take a very, very strong interest in the story you're telling, past all reason, really. And so I think I can relate to that kind of love affair because I have it with books that I read and I have it with things that I'm researching and projects I'm working on. And I think that many people are encouraged as they grow older to have a certain amount of disassociation from something. You're not supposed to think about something all the time. You're supposed to think about a bunch of things for a short period of time. And luckily, I'm in a profession where that's not actually encouraged. You're encouraged to be a little obsessive.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Daniel Handler. He's the author of Why We Broke Up. The novel takes the form of a letter written by a high school girl to her first love. Handler also wrote a series of unfortunate events under the pen name Lemony Snicket.
Did you happen to bring a copy of your book with you?
I didn't, but there's a nice woman from Little Brown now who's rushing into the room with one.
So I'm going to ask you to read this little description. It's on page 80 of your book. This is Min describing a day at her high school.
Oh, yeah. I've read that out loud at various kind of reading series, mostly in bars. And it's something to read that description of a typical high school day. And it starts with people smiling in recognition. And by the end of it, people are generally ordering another round. Okay, here it is. Because the day, it was school. It was the bells too loud or rattly and broken speakers that would never get fixed. It was the bad floors squeaky and footprinted and the bang of lockers. It was writing my name in the upper right-hand corner of the paper or Mr. Nelson would automatically deduct 5 points, and in the upper left-hand corner of the paper or Mr. Peters would deduct 3. It was the pen just giving up midway and scratching invisible ink scars on the paper or suiciding the leak on my hand and trying to remember if I touched my face recently and am I a ballpoint coal miner on my cheeks and chin. It was boys in a fight by the garbage cans for whatever reason, not my friends, not my crowd, my old locker partner crying about it on the bench I sat on freshman year with a gang I barely see anymore. Quizzes, pop quizzes, switching identities during attendance when there's a sub, anything to pass time, more bells. It was the principal on the intercom, 2 whole minutes of ambient hum and shuffling, and then a very clear, "That's on, Dave," and it clicking off. It was a table selling croissants for French Club knocked over by Billy Keeger like always, and the strawberry jam a sticky stain on the ground for 3 days before anyone cleaned it. Old trophies in a box, a plaque with this year's names waiting to be filled in on the tag, blank and coffin-shaped. It was the deep daydream in waking up with a teacher wanting an answer and refusing to repeat the question. Another bell, the announcement, "Ignore that bell," and Nelson scowling, "He said ignore it," to people zipping backpacks. It was the paperwork and homeroom stapled together wrong so everyone has to rotate them to fill them out. It was the bullshit and tryouts for the school play, the banners with the big game Friday and then the big banner stolen and the announcement to rat someone out if anyone knew anything. It was Jen and Tim breaking up, Skyler getting his car taken away, the rumor that Angela was pregnant, but then the counter rumor, "No, it's the flu, everyone throws up with the flu." It was the days the sun wasn't even trying to get out of the clouds and be nice for once in its starry life. It was wet grass, damp hems, the wrong socks I forgot to throw out and so now found myself wearing, the sneaky leaf falling from my hair where it had nested for hours to surely someone's delight. Serena getting her period and not having anything for it like always, scrounging from girls she didn't even know in the bathrooms during second. Big game Friday, go Beavers, beat them Beavers, the dirty joke so boring to everyone but freshman and Kyle Hapley. Choir tryouts, 3 girls selling knitting to help people in a hurricane. It was the library having nothing to offer no matter what needed looking up. It was 5th period, 6th, 7th, clock watching and cheating on tests just because why not? It was suddenly being hungry, tired, hot, furious, so unbelievably startling sad. 4th period, how could it only be 4th, is what it was. Hester Prynne, Agamemnon, John Quincy Adams, distance times rate equals something, lowest common whatever, the radius, the metaphor, the free market. Someone's red sweater, someone's open folder. It was wondering how someone could lose a shoe, just one shoe, and not see it when it was hopeful on the windowsill for weeks. Call this number on the bulletin board. Call if you've been abused, if you want to kill yourself, if you want to go to Austria this summer with the other losers in the picture. It was strive in bad letters on a fading background. Wet paint on a dry floor. Big game Friday. We need your spirit. Give us your spirit. locker combinations, vending machines, hooking up, cutting class, the secrets of smoking and headphones and the rum in a soda bottle with mints to cover the breath, that one sickly boy with thick glasses and an electronic wheelchair. Thank God I'm not him, or the neck brace, or the rash, or the orthodontics, or that drunk dad who showed up at a dance to hit her across the face, or that poor creature who someone needs to tell, you smell, fix it, or it will never, never, never will it get better for you. The days were all day, every day. Get a grade, take a note, put something on, put somebody down, cut open a frog and see if it's like this picture of a frog cut open. But at night, the nights were you, finally on the phone with you, Ed, my happy thing, the best part.
One of the things about high school is that it is this combination of having agency and not having agency in really weird and arbitrary combinations, and being sort of swept up in things that are like rivers, like some of the prose in your description of high school, and being kind of caught up in hurry up and waits that you have no power over, is a very odd thing to be in, that it is quite a relief to get out of, because at least you know that if you mess up, it's just your fault and you just have to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the most part, high school is designed, it seems, to be the worst possible scenario for the people in it. but frankly, I don't know really what would be better given the scenario one's in adolescence. But certainly, I mean, whenever I visit a high school, I think that if there were adults in an office building and every 40 minutes a bell rang and they had to run across to the opposite end of the office building and then think very hard about something completely different from the thing they were told to think very hard about in the last 40 minutes, no adult would work there. They would say, "This is complete madness. I can't do a whole lot of algebra and then run across this building and get yelled at if I'm late and then have someone say, we're now thinking about Billy Budd and that's all we're thinking about. We're not thinking about algebra that you just had to think about very hard." And that's, in fact, what we put adolescents in, even with the knowledge that adolescent brains and bodies are exactly the wrong kind of brains and bodies to have that kind of thing go on. And yet, by the same token, I'm not an advocate of various experimental education programs that I've visited and taken notes on. It's a tough time. I mean, my hat is off to anyone who makes it through adolescence.
For a little while, my brother, when he was in high school, went to one of those schools. It's like an anarchist school it's like a hyper-democratic school where all of the students vote on everything.
Yeah, I visited some of those schools.
It was a disaster.
Yeah, I mean,
it was a total unmitigated disaster.
Well, I mean, who on earth thinks town hall meetings ought to go on for all day long? You know, and that's kind of what those schools are. I mean, if anything, I think you can emerge from a school thinking, wherever I want to live, I want there not to be a democracy. I would rather live under a king than have any more of this.
Stick around to hear about Daniel Handler's worst high school breakup. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International.
Production of Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is supported in part by the menswear blog Put This On, presenting the Put This On Gentlemen's Association. Members receive a handmade pocket handkerchief in the mail every 60 days. More information at putthison.com. And by Ask Metafilter, thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
This episode of Bullseye is made possible by you and by IFC. Comedy Bang Bang, Friday nights at 10, 9 Central. This week, Zach Galifianakis with Scott Aukerman. More info at ifc.com. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Daniel Handler. He's the author of Why We Broke Up. The novel takes the form of a letter written by a high school girl to her first love. The book also includes illustrations of different objects collected over the course of the relationship, stuff like movie tickets, notes, a pair of earrings. Those illustrations are by the artist Myra Kalman. I was surprised to read that you started with the objects in your collaboration with Myra Kalman. Tell me a little bit about how the sort of structure of the book came about.
Well, I was a fan of Myra's forever, and I somewhat cynically cultivated a friendship with her. I met her and cultivated a friendship with her in order to bamboozle her into working with me because I was such a big fan. And we did a picture book together, published under Lemony Snicket's name, called 13 Words, and that was a more traditional collaboration in which I wrote a manuscript and I gave it to Myra, and she agreed to illustrate it. When we decided to work on something else, I said, well, let's start with you. Why don't you tell me what you want to paint? And I couldn't really imagine what Myra was going to tell me she wanted to paint because she paints so many strange and wondrous things. So for all I knew, I was going to have to write a biography of Sigmund Freud or something. But instead, she showed me various small, ordinary objects that she collected, that she keeps in drawers, rubber bands and bottle caps and matchbooks and all sorts of strange little items. And I started to think about what makes strange items look magical and luminous. And one is when they're painted by Myra Kalman, and the other is when they're infused with romantic memory. And from there, the idea of a long letter with all of these objects infused with romantic memory turning into a novel came into being.
Is that how you ended up writing from the perspective of the girl and not the boy?
Well, I mean, I think the easy answer is that in the case of the relationship between Min and Ed in the novel, if it was written from the point of view of the boy, it would be about half a page long. I've been on this tour, and sometimes people in line have been asking, are you going to write a novel that's from the point of view of Ed? And then I quickly write one on a Post-it for them. It usually says something like, who? Oh, her. So I think one is that Min Green is the character who is full of romantic expression, and so it made sense for her to tell it.
It seems like there has been an explosion of, I guess the adjective is quirky young women in media in the past 10 years or so, and they tend to feel like they are created from a very male perspective, at least to me. I mean, I'm a dude, so maybe I'm not the best judge of this.
Right.
But they tend to feel like just someone was like, well, what's the ultimate chick that me or, I don't know who would be a good example, Patton Oswalt would be into? Patton's awesome. He's been on the show several times. It's not intended as an insult to Patton.
No, of course. I was just picturing an enormous fan of Star Wars. That's all I can picture is a girl for Patton Oswalt.
Well, you know, a girl that's really into movies. And I wonder if you were sort of worried about that trope and sort of self-conscious about it.
I don't think so. I was interested in someone who would take their cues from culture, just because I think that's so much what adolescence is. You know, I mean, by the time you're in sixth grade, the number of pieces of culture you've consumed that are about relationships, that are about how people meet and hook up and stay together or fight or break up or get over each other, you know that entire narrative inside and out before you've had anything that can be construed as a relationship. And I don't know how there would be another way to go about doing it. And I think that that Min's story is a story of someone who's consumed so many romantic pieces of culture that she's trying for a romance that turns out to be impossible in her situation.
There's also an odd relationship between romance as it is represented in the real world, as it is represented in fiction, and romance as it functions, especially in the contemporary real world. I mean, I know that all the girls that I dated when I was in high school, like, I don't even really remember asking any of them out. We certainly never went to any sock hops or anything.
You just hung out and pounced? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, I was a romantic. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, my notion of romance was fueled by a notion of what girls might want, which was fueled by a notion of pieces of culture that I was seeing. And one date that I did, I must have done it 20 times over the course of high school, was take some girl for a walk across the Golden Gate Bridge, because it seemed to me that it was romantic. And it is romantic. But, I mean, it's hard to say when you're that young where the self-consciousness and aping of culture meets a genuine experience. I think there's no other way to go about doing it.
I recently drove across the Golden Gate Bridge. A week ago, not even a week ago, 3 or 4 days ago, I drove across the Golden Gate Bridge. And as I was driving across the Golden Gate Bridge, I literally said out loud to my wife, man, the Golden Gate Bridge really delivers.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, that Golden Gate Bridge, it is awesome.
Yeah, it's extremely well done.
That's all I really have to say on the subject.
Yeah, you'll
the
find
Golden
no
Gate
argument
Bridge.
From me. You heard it here first, NPR listeners. The Golden Gate Bridge, what a place.
It's amazing. They really.
You know where else? I mean, I don't mean to be a name dropper, but Paris, France. That's a hell of a town.
I don't know if you've ever heard about this canyon in Arizona, but it is mighty grand.
Jesse and I are co-hosting a show where we're presenting overlooked treasures, little hidden moments you might not have heard about.
Tell me about your worst breakup in high school.
In ninth grade, she called me while I was babysitting. It was one of those things where you arrive in school and suddenly it's all off with your girlfriend. There's nothing, and you tell yourself, oh, she's just in a bad mood or something. But every time you talk to her over the course of the school day, it's terrible. And then it was a Friday night, I think, and I was babysitting for this kid down the block, and then she called me. She said, I'll call you later, and I said, oh, well, I'll be babysitting, so you have that number when I babysit. And but knowing just the whole time, playing with this kid and making him dinner and things like that, that later my girlfriend was going to call me and dump me because that was clearly what was going to happen. That's what I mostly remember. I remember chatting with the kid, waiting for him to go to bed, knowing that then the phone would ring and that then I would get dumped.
Daniel Handler, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Bullseye. It was really a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. I appreciate your interest.
Daniel Handler is the author of the novel Why We Broke Up, a collaboration with the artist Myra Kalman. He also writes books as Lemony Snicket, and he's got a new series of Lemony Snicket books called All the Wrong Questions, kicking off later this year. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Nico Muhly is a different kind of classical composer. Sure, he went to Juilliard, and yes, he did premiere his work at the English National Opera last year. And of course, he's worked with Philip Glass. But on the other hand, he's collaborated with pop performers like Bjork. He's worked on arrangements for indie groups like Grizzly Bear. And he's been known to rhapsodize about the reality show Jersey Shore on his blog. Nico Muhly says the song that changed his life is a piece by Steve Reich. It's called Music for 18 Musicians. Reich is an American composer. He's composed innovative minimal music for decades and continues to release music today. Music for 18 Musicians was written in 1974 and was Reich's first stab at writing for a large ensemble. Muhly, though, didn't hear the piece until the mid-90s when he bought the CD as a music student. He was 14.
I was sitting on the floor of my parents' house and I just remember sort of popping it in and it starts and you're immediately right there. There's kind of no introductory material and no kind of, it's just, here is the world of this piece. There's this kind of outrageous, decadent bass clarinet thing. And you just think, well, great, that's just excellent. It's kind of in its own world. It sort of outlines at the very beginning what the tools are that it's going to be working with, and then sticks with those. It's an ensemble of amplified sort of strings and woodwinds and mallet instruments It was the first time I realized that music could be fast and slow at the same time. There's this sense of the sort of textural language of the piece being very slowly shifting, sort of like a helicopter shot over a landscape. The most sort of underused instrument, I would say, are the vibraphones, which are used in this kind of structural way to indicate when the pattern will change. What's kind of gorgeous about music for 18 musicians is there's really one instrument that comes in and goes away, which is a pair of maracas, which is this kind of magical moment. But it's a kind of genius thing, right? In this very lush texture, about halfway through, all of a sudden you have these little dry beans. And it was something that sort of felt like the exact right length. It was sort of more of an experience than it was a piece. And then you can sort of come up for air 56 minutes later or whatever it is. Sense of how a composer could function in a community, in a sense, and the idea that you're not making these pieces of heroic narrative, but instead that what you're making is like this kind of thing that could only work with this enormous amount of cooperation, that it required all these people to make this very, very beautiful thing. The same thing you feel if you watch sort of six people operate a gigantic puppet or something. It just felt like something sort of huge coming out of a bunch of small processes in a kind of beautiful way. You know, it was a completely life-altering thing because I hadn't realized that there was music that was so clean and so ecstatic and so measured but also wild and all at the same time.
Nico Muhly on the song that changed his life, Music for 18 Musicians by Steve Reich. You can find Nico Muhly online at nicomuhly.com. That's NICOMUHLY.com.
What happens if you type woman who had face into Google? Sure, you could go find out on your computer, or you could wait and let your radio tell you. I think you should wait. I mean, I have a vested interest. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International.
This episode of Bullseye, supported by you and by IFC, presenting Comedy Bang Bang with Scott Aukerman, Friday nights at 10, 9 Central. Comedy so nice, they banged it twice. Hey gang, Max FunCon East is already half full. If you want to come join us and our friends at WNYC in the Poconos for a weekend of fun and adventure. Yes, that's right, I said adventure. It's not true, but I said it. Then go to MaxFunCon.com to get your tickets now before they're all gone. MaxFunCon.com. Look, I'm not going to tell you who we have booked, but I will say that we have one person booked, a genuine legend who is the single MaxFunCon guest about whom I am most excited ever. MaxFunCon East is October 26th through 28th in the Poconos. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guests, Randy and Jason Sklar, are a stand-up comedy team, twin brothers from St. Louis, Missouri. They're well known for their long-running ESPN classic series, Cheap Seats, and they host Sklarbro Country, a comedy podcast about sports. These days, the Sklars are cracking wise about statistics on a new History Channel show, The United Stats of America. And in case you didn't think these two were busy enough, the twins remain active stand-up performers. Here's a clip from their recent CD, Henderson's and Daughters.
Here's the thing. I think this is a litmus test for us to understand that we're actually getting older. Because at this point in our lives, we would rather stay at a good hotel instead of a hip hotel. And that's the thing. I don't know if you guys have ever stayed at a really hip hotel. But like, it's such a hip hotel that it dares you to admit that it's a shitty hotel, you know? We were staying at this hotel in New York. We go, it's so hip. You go down in the lobby, there's like house music pumping. It's ridiculous. There's a huge plasma flat screen. 50-inch screen, and then the image is Adolf Hitler the devil behind the front desk. And it's like, okay, all right. Excuse me. I just need a... I need a wake-up call tomorrow morning. Can I get a wake-up call at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning? Can I get another wake-up call at 8:10, please? And can I get a fluffy pillow, too? Because the ones that I got are too... What does this have to do with the hotel? I just want a fluffy pillow and two wake-up calls. I don't need the Hitler imagery.
Right.
Or the Hitler remix.
I don't care for that.
So there's something interesting about the dynamic of having two of you on stage, and I want to talk about that a little bit. You are a double act, and you are twins, distinguished visually basically just by the fact that one of you wears glasses.
Yeah. Among other things, but yes. But the main thing is that.
Yeah. Functionally.
Yeah. Sure.
Randy's wearing a baseball hat right now, too, yeah, but and you're wearing different clothes. Right. You don't wear matching outfits.
Not anymore.
Sometimes you perform in sailor suits.
Yes. Those are special USO shows.
So
USO issue.
Very special. Now that they've repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
That's correct.
So I want to ask you a little bit about that and how you developed the style that you perform in. Because there are sort of classic double act styles, and you don't do those things. You're not the Smothers Brothers. Mm-hmm. Did you ever try being the Smothers Brothers?
I don't think we ever...
We couldn't do that. I don't think we could do that.
Because you're both dumb.
Right.
Yes, where we both play are the dumb ones.
And and our mom liked the Smothers Brothers best.
Is that bad?
She preferred them to us. It's always been a very... what's funny about it for us...
I think that's the only conscious decision we've ever made was to not be like... other duos that we've seen.
I think
other
teams. We were this weird entity of this storytelling two-headed monster that kind of we enjoyed the same things and sometimes like double teaming from the same side of a point. And I think it's only recently that we fully understood that what we also have is the ability to, and we love acting, so we also have the ability to play scenes out. Like we have bits in our stand-up where we, you know, go into this whole thing of fairy tales about just not fully buying the third act of like Snow White, you know, and reading those stories to our kids. It all comes from the truth of reading those stories to our kids. And my daughter really likes fairy tales. And it made me question, how are these stories standing the test of time? It's the worst writing. It's so lazy. The fact that fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the blood of an English man doesn't rhyme. And yet you made up the words fee, fi, fo, and fum to me blows my mind. We're like, how does that accept it?
We were like, something else is at work here,
right?
I bet the Brothers Grimm got a lot of creative like notes from their publishers throughout the whole process. And they were like, you know what? This. I don't care if this doesn't rhyme. We're drawing a line in the sand. Try to make us change it. And you know the publishers tried to do that. Like in the 11th hour, they're still kissing these guys' ass trying to get them to change. They're like, Brothers Grimm.
You guys.
We love this story.
Who is a genius?
Who comes up with this?
You
too. A beanstalk that grows in one day?
What?
Magic beans?
That's genius.
A goose that... out golden eggs?
Come on.
The merchandising possibilities are amazing.
It's smart marketing.
It's marketing.
We just came up with a
we
word.
We just made up a
we
word.
We just came up with a new word.
You are.
I have one note.
It's not even a note.
It's not even a thought.
To say it's a thought is to make too big of a deal out of nothing.
Here's the bad version.
Don't do this, but do something exactly like it.
Fee-fi-fo-fan, I smell the blood of an English man. We imagine the Brothers Grimm sitting across the desk. They're like, you f***ing write it.
You do okay? It if you're so smart.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guests are Jason and Randy Sklar. Their latest stand-up comedy album is called Hendersons and Daughters. You can see them exploring statistics on their new History Channel show, United Stats of America.
Sports has never been a huge part of your act, but sports has always been has often been a huge part of your career.
Mm-hmm.
I think because Cheap Seats, your ESPN Classic show, was your big break, may still be the thing that you're best known for.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that in recent years you have drawn those two things closer and closer together. And I wonder if that's like self-conscious. If your part of your thing is like, we want to bring the sports stuff and the alt comedy stuff into one thing rather than having it feel like parallel tracks.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you can't. There's a point at which they won't go. It's like two magnets pushing against each other and they just won't go that way. What we try to do is say with our podcast that and Patton Oswalt's a great guest to have on the podcast because he understands this as a nerd of other things like comic books and movies and stuff like that. He's like, there is no difference between the sports nerd and the comic book nerd and the comedy nerd and this. It's all nerddom, but in different ways. And so that's where we try and say the thing is we can't assume that an alternative audience knows too much. Like there's a joke that we tell in our act about our friend Morgan Murphy, who's a very funny comedian, asked us once in a funny way, and I just love this joke. Like she said, did you take 9/11 harder than most people because you're twins? I was like, it's a great question. And I was like, okay, well, to be honest with you, there was one moment on 9/12/2001 where I was like, oh my God, are we next? And then the sports nerd in us every time wants to then make this joke, and we do it on stage, but to a lot of times to just very little laughter, which is the sports nerd says, and then Jason.
That I called Hakeem Olajuwon and Ralph Sampson, and I was like, do not hang out together because they're going after twins. They're going after towers.
These are two guys who in the 1980s played for the Houston Rockets, and they were called the Twin Towers. It just to us is like.
I was like, you can hang out with Clyde Drexler individually, another player from those teams.
And we go that far. And so for us, there's something wonderful in to be able to kind of go that far. It's almost like someone like Patton making a silver surfer joke or whatever, you know, that like or Brian Posehn making a deep metal heavy metal joke, and
right.
It's like we don't care. We're kind of at the point now where we can go to that place and that's fine, although we do realize we got this new show coming out on the History Channel. It's not about sports at all. It's more about statistics, even though statistics have a lot to do with sports. For us, we're like, we're glad because it's kind of sending us out into a broader area where we're still trying to be very specifically our own brand of comedy. But to try and stay in that broad area, I think, is good for us. We don't want to go so far down the road of sports and just sports.
Tell me about this History Channel show that you've got coming up about statistics.
Yes, it's called the United Stats of America. And it's about how statistics tell the story of why we are who we are at this moment. Like each show starts with a statistic. One of the shows is we used to be the tallest nation in the world until 1950, and now we're ninth. So what happened? We're behind Belgium.
Those Belgians!
Those waffle eaters. Bastards. I won't even watch In Bruges.
I won't even eat my fries with mayonnaise.
It's pretty shocking and upsetting, but it's interesting. And it sort of unearths a ton of other stats about how we live, how we eat, how we work. And it ends up sort of being a sociological exploration of America using stats as the entry point. So that's an episode. We do one on time. We do one on space. We do one on death. We do one on
what are the seven inventions that moved us around in this kind of population shifts.
Population shifts. So it kind of is like a way to sort of look at the story of America through stats. And obviously, you know, they wanted a host for the show that could bring it to life and make it funny because stats on their own aren't necessarily that
riveting, but it worked out great for us. We weren't even in the mix to audition for the show, and they had a casting session in New York, and then they had one in LA, and the guy from Left Right, it's the same company that did This American Life for Showtime. Really quality, amazing production company. They care about making it look good. It looks really cool. So they're great people working on it. The guy from Left Right Media was driving around to their casting session and he heard us on NPR doing the little sports report that we do on the Madeline Brand Show here at KPCC in Southern California. And he was like, this is exactly what we're looking for. They're taking this sort of foreign subject of sports and they're explaining it to people who might not understand it. And they're trying to be funny, which they are. He's like, we got to get these guys to come in. And that's how we got called in to do the show or to audition for the show. And then we got it. But it's kind of a rare situation where it works out like that in this industry.
And so we shot all six of them. Six. It started out as being just a pilot that was for internal use only, that they were going to shoot one, not even a finished version, like a rough cut of what it was. And then they were like, let's do six of these. And so now we're waiting. Hopefully April.
It will air
start in April. And we'll see how it does. I mean, part of me says, look, it's probably, you never know how it's going to do. The shows that really rate well on History Channel are like Swamp People and Pawn Stars and American Pickers. And this is not that. Okay, this isn't someone finding a Civil War musket in their attic.
Which, by the way, those shows are brilliant. I mean, those shows are like Redneck Antiques Roadshow. It's like literally like, I found this jar in my closet and what's it worth? And like you literally, I've been on flights watching those shows and cannot stop watching for hours and hours because I'm like, I want to know.
What is it worth? Real? Is it real? I mean,
so you get a beginning, a middle, then they make you wait through the break, and then you find out what happens. And it just goes over and over again. It resets, and it's kind of genius. And so those shows just draw tons of people because that's kind of mindless, really great entertainment, solid, like, let's just watch this and turn our brains off. Ours is a little different. Ours is comedy. It requires attention, focus, learning.
It's different. So
it's, yeah, it requires
people. We'll see how it does. There may be a ceiling as to how well this show can do, but I love it and would love to continue doing it and feel.
Yeah,
like,
we're proud of them so far.
It this way. If this is the thing that people know us from, you mentioned like Cheap Seats before in Scarborough Country, and you know, we've done Entourage and done some other things that people really know us from. But if this is the thing, and History does pretty well, their numbers are pretty good. If this is the thing that most people know us from, I'll be happy. I'll be ecstatic. I mean, that's all we've ever wanted to do in our career, is make sure that the next step of whatever we do is something that if people saw it, we wouldn't be embarrassed about it.
Well, Randy Sklar, Jason Sklar, the Sklar brothers, thank you so much for joining me on Bullseye.
Thanks for having us.
Randy and Jason Sklar, the Sklar brothers, have a comedy CD. It is called Hender Sons and Daughters. They're also the hosts of Sklarborough Country, which you can find online at earwolf.com. Every week on Bullseye, we close with a cultural suggestion from me to you. It's The Outshot. In 2000, Curb Your Enthusiasm premiered on HBO. In 2001, The Office premiered on the BBC. They were at the forefront of a comedy revolution, twisting the knife of social awkwardness until all you could do was laugh. But those shows weren't without precedent. In 1997, a veteran comedy writer named Ken Finkelman launched a CBC show called The Newsroom. Finkelman wrote, directed, and starred in the show, playing the news director of an unnamed Canadian TV news show. That character, George Findlay, is one of the most brilliantly horrible men ever to appear on television. George is the kind of man whose concern for immigrants correlates directly to his concern for his BMW.
The parking guy told me he'd meet with me.
He will squeeze you in tomorrow on his break, but he can't promise anything.
If all the spots are gone, how busy can he be? What does he mean he'll squeeze me in?
Well, apparently he has to re-stencil names on spaces all day.
They get their names stenciled on the spaces? I'm a news director. I don't even get a space. I have to park across the street for $7 a day. 15 when there's a ball game. The guy that parks my car is an Ethiopian doctor. That's the truth. This is not what they're trained to do. This is what's wrong with our immigration policy. They should let these guys practice medicine. I'd rather have them operate on my heart than park my car. Do you know the three scariest words an Ethiopian doctor can say to a BMW owner? Huh? Do you? leave the keys.
George isn't a bloviator like Ricky Gervais was. He's an avoider, a dancer, willing to go to any length to avoid the uncomfortable, and almost always failing.
His agent spoke to you about a lunch, and he wants to set up a time and place.
Not now.
Okay.
Is this the announcer with Lou Gehrig's disease? Yes, I'm aware of his condition, and I'll talk to him later, okay?
Well, when?
I don't know when. Later.
He's kind of old. I feel sorry for him.
I have my reasons for not wanting to get pushed into this lunch, okay?
He's an over-the-hill announcer who can do nothing for your career except diminish your reputation as a player by being seen with you in public.
Ding, ding, ding. So you guys think I'm afraid to take this lunch?
Well, I think if it was Lou Gehrig with Bill Coogan's disease rather than the other way around, you'd take the lunch.
Exactly. Okay. Book a reservation for 2, Café Brussels. It's a restaurant where everyone big in this business eats. Satisfied?
I'm impressed.
Now, I'm not a person without feelings, right? But this dog, when is this dog going to die? Really, I mean, what's the prognosis on this dog?
If you haven't spent some time with George, you owe it to yourself. The Newsroom is on DVD. That's it for Bullseye this week. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer, Julia Smith. Nick White is our editor. Our intern is Justin Morissette. Our theme music is Huddle Formation by The Go Team. Thanks to The Go Team and their label, Memphis Industries, for letting us use that. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org, on Twitter, at Bullseye, or on Facebook at Facebook.com/Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. And remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Production of Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is supported in part by the menswear blog Put This On, presenting the Put This On Gentlemen's Association. Members receive a handmade pocket handkerchief in the mail every 60 days. More information at putthison.com. And by Ask Metafilter, thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.